Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk. This is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, CORBETTREPORT.com, CorbettReport.com with two T's. James has been living and working in Japan since 2004. Started the Corbett Report as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. Editorial writer for the International Forecaster. And he was recently invited to speak in Japan. He traveled from Japan to the Netherlands to make a public presentation on the political and economic situation in Central Eurasia and what we might be able to see in the future. Hello, James. How are you doing?
Well, I am doing very well today. Thank you, as always, for having me on. And before we start, at the risk of boring some of the listeners, I just want to extend my congratulations to you on the program that you do here, because I know you often start by saying very laudatory and nice things about me, but I'd like to extend that to you. If the listeners, either at my website that listen to this broadcast on a weekly basis, or of course your listeners, do appreciate these conversations, I would like them to reflect on the fact that that is a good reflection on the interviewer, because it is generally interesting questions that provoke interesting answers. So I want to just say thank you so much for having me on. You always ask such interesting questions, and I genuinely look forward to our conversations.
Well, I do too, and I certainly appreciate your appreciation. So now we've got kind of a mutual appreciation society going. let's do a few questions. Here's something that's a subjective observation with me. I do radio programs on a daily basis with Melody, and I have to find a number of articles every day that we can possibly talk about during the course of the program and prepare a kind of script where we put something together and say, well, we'll talk about this and this and this and this. And last July, for example, I might have to review 10 articles to find one that I was willing to talk about on the program. Today, if I look at 10 articles, I've got 10 that I want to talk about on the program. Mm-hmm. It seems that the quality, the magnitude, and the rate of news is accelerating and growing more intense. And it's something that I can see subjectively. Do you see the same thing, or am I just getting a little too old to pay close attention to what's happening?
No, I very much hear you. I understand what you're saying. To some extent, that might be, I mean, I don't know. There's a lot of different factors that go into that. And it may be the fact that I'm able to appreciate the importance of a lot more different pieces of information just the longer that I've been looking at it. So there may be some of that in there. But I think objectively, there are a lot of things happening in the world that are of greater import today than there was even a decade ago. And this is a phenomenon that's been noted. I want to say it was Lenin, Vladimir Lenin, that originally said that there are times in history where more happens in a month than happens in the previous decade or something along those lines. I may be butchering that quote and I may be misattributing it, but someone said that. And I think this is one of those times where we just have so much going on in the world that is of such great import. That I hear you. I think it's a real phenomenon that's happening now that we have too much to keep our eyes on almost. And I think that's due to a number of different factors, but I think we are going through a significant transition point in world history that is related to the decline of Pax Americana and the sort of American-led unipolar world. And at times like that, there's just going to be a lot of things to keep our eye on. So no shortage of things to talk about.
What about people in positions of power? Yeah, they have as much or more. You know, I'm sitting here trying, I think I'm doing something special if I can juggle four balls instead of three. They have to juggle 20 or 30. Can they keep up?
That's a very good question, and I'm not sure, well, I mean, I'm sure they would like to think so, and they would like to, us to believe that that is the case. Maybe it isn't. Maybe it's too much for any one person to organize, but we have to keep in mind that, of course, it isn't just individuals that are looking over this. There are, of course, entire institutions that have been created to deal with this, and that have become these generational institutions that have now been in charge of U.S. foreign policy and foreign policy of other countries for decades and generations at this point. If you look at the Council on Foreign Relations or its counterparts in various countries around the world, these types of organizations that have some of the brightest people in the world working for them. I mean, I think it would be a very much a disservice and against our own interests to underestimate the brain power of some of these peoples in these organizations that are very much in positions of power, the true positions of power, I would say, the ones, the sort of power behind the throne rather than the political positions of power, where we often make remarks about the stupidity of politicians and how they just don't understand what's happening. And that may or may not be true, but I think the real political power is in these international institutions and in these quasi-governmental institutions that are wielding power behind the thrones. And they really do have some very bright people working for them. So I think we shouldn't underestimate the brain power that goes into keeping track of these various balls in the air, I guess.
You know, the problem with brain power, though, it's an admirable capacity, but it's usually associated, big brain is often associated with a big ego. And when you get, even if you have some magnificently intelligent people in positions of power, when things become unstable, there has to be some serious disagreements. And the solution that one genius might advocate is going to be completely different from the solution that another genius may advocate, and they may not be able to agree on who's right. And to what extent do you suppose ego plays a role in destabilizing or at least complicating our international relations, the economy, the politics right now?
I think that plays a much larger role than we would want, at any rate. I mean, supposedly, if we do go along with the narrative that these people are looking after our interests, then we should be aware that that things like just ego and things like that very much do get in the way. And it is interesting to look at the hubris, I think, of a lot of people who get into these positions of political power and sort of flex their muscles. This sort of intellectual technocratic class that likes to, that aims to become people of influence and angles their way into positions of power, because there is, I think, a type of hubris associated with that practice. And perhaps no better example of that has been provided to us in recent times than the remarks of Jonathan Gruber, the Obamacare architect, who has been caught on tape multiple times basically denigrating the intelligence of Americans. Oh, they're all stupid, and that's how we managed to pass this Obamacare. I mean, just unbelievable that someone would actually say that out in the open in public forums and not expect to be called out on it. But that is the type of hubris of the intellectual class. And I saw a recent video that I'll point your listeners to. It's called Obamacare Architect Jonathan Gruber versus Eric Hoffer, and it's up on YouTube, so people can look at that. And basically, it's Gruber's remarks basically saying how stupid the American people are, contrasted with Eric Hoffer, who's an American philosopher who actually worked as a longshoreman through his life up until his retirement, but he penned these remarkable books on philosophy on the side, and he talked about the hubris of intellectuals and how a rule by intellectuals is the worst kind of rule that we can institute, because basically the intellectuals are stupid in a way. I mean, they may be very smart when it comes to certain tasks and certain ideas, but they are extremely hubris-filled and unable to see the sort of reality of the average person. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. So even if these people are the best and the brightest in some sense, I think they may be emotionally stupid. They may be socially stupid. They may be stupid in a lot of other ways that may ultimately be their downfall. And in some ways, since I am very much opposed to this type of oligarchical, intellectual, technocratic power, I certainly hope it will be their downfall. But I guess time will tell on that point.
We can talk about people who are intellectual rising to positions of power, and they become perhaps arrogant. And you were quoting from someone who said that the rule by the intellectuals, the arrogant intellectuals, that's not the exact quote, but intellectuals. He described it, if I understood you correctly, as perhaps the worst kind of rule you can have. But is it really worse than rule by rich people? The oligarchy is based on money. I mean, if you want to see some arrogant people who really don't have much empathy for others, I'm going to guess you could find a lot of them.
Yes.
At some of the finest country clubs in the world and at the, you know, hanging around the Federal Reserve might not work there, but they may be familiar with its operation.
Yes.
What's worse? Intellectual money.
Well, I think you're right to point out that that split, because I think that that is a more fleshed out view of the way the system really runs. I think that what we have is, of course, the first level of political reality, which is kind of the cartoon level that's presented as the lowest common denominator on the nightly news, that, you know, the president makes all the decisions and the government is just the Congress and all of this. And I think behind that, of course, we have the power behind the throne of the intellectual technocrats and the whatever, Brzezinski's, Kissinger's, whoever that you might place into that class. But I think behind that, of course, there are the sort of family line, old world moneyed elite that sponsor and literally buy and pay and control, I think, the technocrats, who are really more like gophers for these people. And I think once you get into that realm, yes, I mean, ultimately, I mean, these people are not just hubristic. They genuinely believe they have a genetic scientific right to rule over the masses that's been granted to them by this eugenics ideology that was dreamt up in the last century, and that I think is really a religion to these people, as perhaps best reflected by the fact that the Rockefeller-funded Riverside Church in New York City has the bust of Darwin and others, because this really is this type of eugenics-driven elite that I think is behind the technocratic class. So I think that's the real vision of this society. At the very top of the pyramid, it's not the technocrats, it's the moneyed family bloodlines that I think have been in some positions of power for centuries. But so I think the real contrast would be that sort of financial backing to the technocratic power versus a vision of society where the masses are left more or less alone to organize in ways that are responsive to their needs. And that is ultimately what Eric Hoffer is talking about in that clip that I just talked about, where he said, you know, the intellectuals believe that they can create this sort of system that will encapsulate everything and that they can control everything. But really, the best way to harness the true power of humanity, the true potential of the human species, is to leave people alone to organize in ways that respond to their own needs. And I am very much in accord with that idea. I think the answer to this is not going to be found in constructing a better system or a different system. It's the idea that we can escape this idea that everything has to be encapsulated in a system. And that's very difficult for the intellectuals to leave alone, because of course they do want to try to systematize everything and make everything fit into their, all of these square pegs fit into their round holes.
Yep. Part of the reason they do that, my dad had a little business. He and his partner started something in a garage back in the 1950s, probably. They wound up having a little electroplating business, and they did well. They worked hard, and they did well. But I can remember my dad telling me, and he was working a job to support the business. His partner was running the business in the garage, and he had another job he was working at and contributing money to support their partnership and their business. And they struggled, and one thing, they went through, and they became reasonably successful, not spectacularly, but reasonably successful. But I remember him telling me how much their income increased when they began to hire employees. And they understood, they learned the lesson that I might be able to earn $100,000 on my own, working by myself. But if I can get myself an employee, by the time I'm done, I can make enough money off that guy where I'm going to, my personal profit's probably going to go to $120,000. Just by having one employee, I can increase my income by 20%. Now I'm using that as an example. That's not what my father said, but I can remember him telling me this, and this would go back 1950s, and it was the lesson he'd learned. So where I'm going with this is that employees can make you rich. Insofar as you function as a lone wolf, it's very difficult to make a spectacular or even substantial income. But when you start employing people, you can. And therefore, as soon as you learn that, you have an incentive to get these people, put those square pegs in the round holes, because you can make money off those employees. And that's one of the big incentives. We're not going to let people just run on their own. Come over here. Here, I'm going to give you a job. Work for me. You know? And we take advantage of people that way. And it becomes an impediment to your idea that just leave people alone. Well, we'd be glad to leave them alone unless we can make some money off of them. If we can do that, then we're inclined, wait, let's organize these people. You see what I'm saying?
I really do. And that's an interesting way of contextualizing that, because I of course, experienced some of that myself. Here I am, this lone wolf who for the last 3 years has been able to make this website my full-time employment. But of course, it's just me. I mean, I do everything. I edit and post and research and do everything with regards to this material. But I'm at a point where I now see I could do so much more if I could just hire an employee to help me out. But, oh, I don't have the finances to do that. But it's also the question of the more people that you start adding to that, the more you sort of lose the ultimate control of that, the more you lose the vision. To a certain extent, you have to entrust it out to others, which dilutes the message potentially. So it is interesting. I'm facing some of that in my own work now and thinking about it. Will that start to happen to me? And will I have to start coordinating people rather than coordinating ideas? So it's all very interesting. But of course, when you extend that out to the societal level, of course, there is that profit incentive. And you can look at something like Obamacare. One of the main incentives for that is, of course, the insurance companies who help to write the legislation get to profit from it immensely by forcing people to buy their insurance. I mean, that's a wonderful gig if you can get it. But I think beyond that, I mean, there are other motives that come in when you're starting to deal at the societal level like that.
Let's talk about these other motives when we return. Yes. We'll take a break for some commercial announcements, and James Corbett and I will be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adask. My guest is James Corbett. We are Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. We're talking about human motives and how they apply and may push us into systems where we seek to control each other. And perhaps because we think I can profit, if I can control someone else, I can make a profit off this. There's money to be made in control. There's power. We're inclined to do it. I think is this an attribute of just the nature of our culture right now? The nature of, 21st century life, you got to control somebody to make a profit? Or is it part of human nature?
Well, unfortunately, I would say it is deeper than that. I would say it is part of human nature. But as I was saying before the break, I think that the money, the profit incentive is only one part of this, or only one layer of it. And it certainly does exist, absolutely. And as I was saying, for example, in the Obamacare situation, obviously the health insurance companies that helped to write that legislation directly profit from it. So that's an obvious motive. But expand that discussion outwards a little bit and take a look at someone like, for example, Bill Gates. Obviously, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, handling billions upon billions of dollars in grants and trying to direct resources to various problems so that they can help solve these problems. And obviously, I'm a bit skeptical and cynical about that. But take a look, for example, at the way that Bill Gates talks about the healthcare situation in the United States. And a couple of years ago, he was on camera at a technology conference, but he was being asked about these types of issues, and he was talking about, well, we don't have enough money to fund the education system, so where are we going to find this money? And you look at something like the healthcare system, where millions of dollars are spent on providing palliative care in the last few years of life of a patient who's in their 70s or 80s and can't really be expected to enjoy that care. Why don't we divert some of that money from the end-of-life care for these people and put it in and decide to hire a dozen teachers with that money? And then he makes a very interesting statement. He says, oh, but that would be the death panels, and we're not supposed to talk about that, which is an interesting admission coming from Bill Gates, isn't it? But that, I think, speaks to a different and maybe even deeper and underlying motivation. Obviously, Bill Gates, the multi-billionaire, is not motivated by the idea that he's going to make some money from this scheme or more money. At this point, I mean, money for someone like that is just pieces of paper. What motivates him is the underlying idea of being that sort of God and playing God and deciding this person lives, this person dies, I'll divert this money over here, I'll construct the perfect society, obviously playing on that ego. And of course, we shouldn't dismiss the fact that his father was actively involved in Planned Parenthood, and the Gateses have a professed fondness for the sorts of eugenics ideals that we were talking about earlier. And then when you really start to expand that out and look at what's possible when people start thinking and start having the resources to direct societies in that way, it becomes actually quite, I think, rather scary in a way when you start to think about what's possible. And look at someone like Bertrand Russell, who back in 1953 was writing about the type of scientific society that's coming into view, where he wrote, diet, injections, and injunctions will combine from a very early age to produce the sort of character and the sort of beliefs that the authorities consider desirable, and any serious criticism of the powers that be will become psychologically impossible. Which, of course, was something that was being at least contemplated as much as 60, 70 years ago now. And think about how much further along the actual implementation of those types of technologies is by this point. Or look at someone like the Charles Galton Darwin, of course, part of the Galton Darwin Wedgwood inbred family line that really did practice what they preached when it came to eugenics and thought that they would be able to interbreed to create the perfect humans. One of the progeny of that family line, Charles Galton Darwin, I think the grandson of Charles Darwin, was the wrote a book called The Next Million Years, where he talked about basically the it takes a million years for a species to evolve, like humanity, but we can do that in the course of generations now with technology, by basically manipulating people's underlying biology and things of that nature. That was written, I believe, in the 1930s. So this is something that's been talked about for a very long time, and I think this is the type of societal engineering that we're talking about when we start to go beyond the profit motive and look at what's really underlying and really motivating these people, for whom money really isn't the motivating factor.
I think what we're talking about, we can talk about making the perfect human or whatever, all right? And we can say, oh, we're going to perfect this. But I think what we're really talking about is not necessarily turning everyone into a genius, for example, or turning everyone into a well-adjusted member of society. I think we're talking about getting rid of the morons, all right, the violent, whatever. We are talking about culling the herd, in my opinion. We're not just talking, when we talk about manipulation, how we're going to manipulate, we're going to remove some people from the gene pool. That's the implication. I watched Bill Gates on he was talking about nuclear power in an interview with someone. Oh, I saw the interview maybe 6-8 weeks ago. I'm not sure when it was conducted, but fairly recently. And Bill Gates was talking about the operation of nuclear power plants and how important it was to automate the plants. And he said, because we don't want any more people in there than absolutely necessary. And I saw him, and it was as if someone had asked him to handle some snakes, all right? And it was the idea, though, they're all slimy and I don't want to touch any of these snakes. That was the impression I had of his impression or his reaction to people. He's not averse to getting rid of a lot of people. I mean, his idea of making a better world is not making a better world for everybody, but I think just thinning the herd.
Unfortunately, you're correct. And I think people will point out, and perhaps quite rightly, when they look at someone like Bill Gates, part of that must be his underlying character as someone who's attracted to computers and sort of the world of programming, you know, robot kind of things with that, or programs at any rate, that will do what you tell them to do. I think that obviously appeals to a certain type of person and personality, but I think it's something that is a common trait of the technocratic class, that really people are just things to be used for a given end, and it really doesn't matter, obviously.
Even the used, how useful are 20, 30, 40% of the American people right now in a world that's becoming increasingly robotized, if there is such a word?
Yes, right? Yes.
We're going to see more and more. How useful are these people?
Well, you're exactly right. I think up until this point in society, there has always been a need for a large working class to perform the manual labor that was needed to underlie the economy. But you're right. We are reaching an inflection point where that is no longer needed. And that was pointed out, that's been pointed out for a number of years now, perhaps most notably back in 2000 in Wired magazine, in an article called "Why the Future Doesn't Need Us" by Bill Joy, where he was Bill Joy, the co-founder of Sun Microsystems, and was talking about the various technology conferences and things that he'd attended, where he was talking about the way that this is openly discussed. You know, we really don't need humans, as many humans as we used to. We're reaching that point where nanotechnology and genetic engineering and robotics is making the human species an endangered species in many ways, and this scared Bill Joy enough for him to go and write this article, which is really quite revealing in a number of ways. But for others, it's like a pet project, and they're sort of reveling in it. That should be very, very bone chilling to a lot of people out there who have to think about the ways that, I mean, anyone who's probably listening to this conversation, unless you have 7 or 8 digits after in your bank account, or maybe 9 or 10, you're probably not even going to be included in the conversation regarding this, let alone, you know, considered for perpetuation. And I don't want to make this into something that sounds like some sort of sci-fi fantasy or something. I think there's a long documented history of this that involves, again, a lot of families, family legacies, including the Gates and others, that have ascribed to this eugenics philosophy that underlies this.
You know, it's interesting to speculate about Bill Gates' personality and perhaps his wife's personality. They've had one child, so far as I know. I don't think they're going to have another one. Do you know if I'm correct about that? Or whether they... I think they've only had one child.
You may be correct, but they might have multiple children. I did a report recently that talked about the school that they go to, which doesn't... will not use the Common Core curriculum that the Gates Foundation is helping to fund, which is, I think, telling in and of itself. But I can't remember if it was one or two children.
Well, regardless, it's just, I wonder how those children are going to grow up, because having any children at all has to be a little bit hypocritical for Gates insofar as he believes in, I think he's inclined not just to have planned parenthood, but perhaps to reduce the population. And he's taking a chance that his children are going to be a burden rather than the intellectuals, or aristocrats, or whatever, who will survive when the rest of the great unwashed are culled from the herd. It's what we live in, dangerous times, and dangerous for this reason. The underclass that's subject to being culled is going to sense this before it's all over. And we have to wonder, are they going to riot? Are they going to burn down not just neighborhoods, but cities? What's going to happen here as they fight for their survival, as they certainly will? I mean, we've got a group of people say, you people need to die. Got another group of people say, oh, no, we're going to survive. You need to die. Are we coming on something like the French Revolution? Shall we invest in guillotines?
Yes, well, not quite. I don't think that's going to be the template for future revolution, but it is something to think about. I mean, I think we are going to move into a sort of revolutionary era, but I don't think it will look quite like the French Revolution or any revolution that's preceded it. I think this is a revolution that in some ways has been being prepared for in the United States specifically, as well as in other places, for a very, very long time. And in the United States context, I'd point to Rex 84 and some of these other plans for the implementation of martial law that have been worked on for decades and decades now. And this is well established and well ensconced, I think, in various branches of the U.S. government and the continuity of government plans and things like this. I mean, there has been a concerted effort to create a plan for the disintegration of American society for a very long time. And I think it's at least on the cards that can be used in the event of one of those types of revolutionary society or societal revolutions. But the point, I think, of that is that it's not that this is going to be used to wrap everything up in a controllable way so much as maybe the disintegration is the point. Ultimately, again, it's going to be a very small clique of the, you know, the Gates and whoever, you know, that those types of people who want to be at the very top of a system of a very, very, very few, a thinned out herd, as it were. So yeah, the complete disintegration of a society like the United States may ultimately be in their interest. And unfortunately, the entire infrastructure for that has been set up with the militarization of the police and the implementation of these martial law plans and all of this. It's a very worrying scenario.
We can talk about disintegration, and if you want to call the herd, disintegration is a good way to do it. You don't have to go out there and set up concentration camps. You don't have to march people through, into gas chambers or whatever. All you have to do is cut off the food supply, and they will start competing amongst themselves for whatever scraps they can find, and they'll start killing each other off. And all you have to do is just protect yourself and your family and your castle, get it surrounded by, enough martial forces where you are protected, and just let the rest of them kill each other off and see who survives. And so the disintegration feeds that culling.
And while we're on the theme of the Gates, they are major investors in the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, which is located in Norway on a secluded island that is basically this seed vault that's designed to survive whatever type of global cataclysm may come, including the infection of the world's food supply with GMO monstrosities. This seed vault buried deep in a mountainside will basically preserve the genetic heritage of the Earth in case, I guess, there is some sort of cataclysmic event and we need to repopulate the Earth, or at least reseed it after everything is said and done. The Gates Foundation, one of the major investors in this.
After all the genetically modified foods fail or cause consequences we can't control, somebody says, hey, maybe we need to go back to heritage seeds, and we just happen to have a stack of them up there on an island in the, near Norway. We've got about 30 seconds left, James. You want to give us a pitch for Corbett Report?
Just CorbettReport.com, CORBETTReport.com is a one-stop shop for everything along these lines. And I should point out that we were both wrong. Apparently, the Gates have 3 children.
Really?
Apparently so.
Well, did you get an email on that, or are you doing research while
I can research while talking. It's one of my skills.
Well, then we'll find out next time. I'll ask you if you can do research, talk, and chew bubblegum at the same time. Then you're really among the elite.
I guess we'll talk next year.
Yeah, that's true. Have a good Christmas. Happy holidays. James Corbett from the Corbett Report, thank you for being on the program. Look forward to talking to you beginning of next year. Thank all of you folks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, with good Lord, bless you, me, James, and Frank, the producer. Bye-bye.
Merry Christmas.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay.
Ain't it sad?
And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me.